Welcome to SCOTUS Cast. You can say that on television, post-decision, debate edition. Thank you for tuning in. On January 21st, 2009, the Supreme Court announced its decision in Citizens United v. FEC. The court struck down as inconsistent with the First Amendment a provision of the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act regarding independent expenditures by corporations that the FEC had said would forbid the airing of advertisements about a documentary about Hillary Clinton that Citizens United sought to air during the 2008 primary season. To discuss this case, we have the director of the Election Law Program at The Ohio State University Moritz College, Professor Edward B. Foley, and the Josiah H. Blackmore II and Shirley M. Nault Professor of Law at Capital University Law School, Professor Bradley A. Smith. To moderate the discussion, we have Supreme Court Advocate and Free Speech and Election Law Practice Group Executive Committee Member Eric S. Jaffe. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speakers. And now, Professor Foley, Professor Smith, and Mr. Jaffe.
Hello, and welcome to the Federalist Society's SCOTUS Cast series. Today, we're going to be discussing the decision handed down yesterday by the United States Supreme Court in Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission, striking down a portion of the election laws and overruling some earlier precedents addressing speech by corporations and unions. With me today, I have Brad Smith, a former commissioner of the FEC and currently a professor of law at Capital University in Columbus, Ohio. Brad is the chair of the Center for Competitive Politics and filed an amicus brief in the Citizens United case in his role as former commissioner. Also with me today is Ned Foley, professor of law at Ohio State University Moritz College of Law. He is the director of the election law program there, and he is a former consultant to attorneys representing Senators McCain and Feingold in the challenge to the McCain-Feingold legislation in McConnell versus FEC. With that said, I will turn to Brad. Brad, please take it away.
All right. Well, thanks, Eric. And Ned, good to be here with you. Obviously, I'm delighted by the decision this week. I think it's a wonderful First Amendment decision. And I think the stakes here can really be seen by looking at what was the government's position in the case. The government's position in this case was that it had the authority to ban the distribution of books through Amazon's Kindle system, that it had the authority to prevent corporate publishers such as Simon & Schuster from publishing a book, and stores such as Barnes & Noble from selling that book if it contained even one sentence of candidate-based political advocacy. The government's position was that it could regulate incorporated websites such as the website of the Sierra Club or AndrewSullivan.com. And it was really, and the government's position was that it could prohibit a union from paying an author to write a book that might be titled something like Why Working Americans Should Support Barack Obama's Agenda for America. It's a very, very far-reaching position, and it was based on a reading of a 1990 case, Austin versus Michigan Chamber of Commerce, and I think the government read that case correctly. I mean, that is, I think, ultimately what that case stands for. It is a 20-year-old precedent. It is not, despite what has been said frequently, a 100-year-old precedent. It is true that there have been laws on the books banning corporate expenditures and campaigns for 100 years, but those laws had never been tested all the way through in court, and for most of their history, there was no reason to, because the laws were so full of holes and easy evasions and lack of enforcement that corporations simply had no particular interest, and unions, in challenging them. Unions had challenged some of these statutes in the 1940s and 50s, but those cases had never ended up dealing with the actual constitutional issue. So I think when we, you know, look at those First Amendment stakes, we get a little different look from the hysteria we've heard from people on the sort of advocacy reform groups. I don't mean the academics like Ned, but people like Common Cause and so on, which have been talking about, you know, this is terrible, torrents of corporate money flooding into America and so on. I also think on that last point that this is an important decision, that it will increase the amount of spending by corporations and unions. I think that's probably a good thing. I think there are times when Americans should hear directly, unfiltered, from corporations and unions. But it's not so radical, again, as some have tried to make it seem. I mean, the fact is right now that 28 states, which represent about 60% of the nation's population, already conduct their state elections for Supreme Court and governor and state offices, state legislature, under exactly that legal regime. And I don't think there's any evidence that these states are not functioning as Democratic Republican states, or that they've become dominated by the special interest in ways that other states haven't. Indeed, many of those states are consistently rated among the best governed states in the country. States like Utah and Virginia, states like Oregon are not exactly considered hotbeds of corruption. I think you would find these states disproportionately represented among the more prosperous and more successful state governments in America. So, you know, to me, that is what was basically at stake in this case. And I think it's good. It's the first time in, I think, really since Austin, that the court has taken seriously the First Amendment issues involved and recognized that while we don't always like the results, the reason for the First Amendment was precisely to keep the government out of the business of deciding, you know, who's spoken enough or who needs to speak more, of keeping them out of the business of deciding, well, we don't want this kind of group or this kind of person speaking, which is essentially what these corporate bans do. It's worth noting that the bans would apply not only to for-profit corporations, but to nonprofit corporations. So again, all in all, a great day for free speech, one that's firmly rooted in precedents, one that overturns a precedent which was not so old, just 20 years old, and it sort of stuck out as the odd man out in the Supreme Court's First Amendment jurisprudence. And I think Americans should be very happy for this, and I think they'll quickly discover that the various horror stories they're hearing simply will not come true.
Thank you, Brad. Over to you, Ned.
Thanks very much, and good to be here and part of this discussion. As Brad suggests, from his perspective, you know, the First Amendment is all on his side, and his side prevailed. His side certainly prevailed on this ruling, but the First Amendment landscape is much more complicated. There are a lot of shades of gray and a lot of line drawing to be done, and that's true after this decision as well as before. Brad mentioned some examples of fact patterns that where the First Amendment interest is high and the government's regulatory interest is low. But you can imagine other fact patterns where the balance is just in the opposite direction. In fact, the court in Citizen United alluded to one but left it open for a future day. What was that? That's the case of foreign entities, foreign corporations or foreign governments wanting to inject money into U.S. election systems. They didn't have to decide that case in the Citizen United opinion because there wasn't a foreign entity at play, but that's a scenario that Congress needs to think about. I think the court would uphold congressional legislation that said the government of China, the government of Russia, what have you, shouldn't be spending money to influence U.S. elections. Once you accept that principle, you've got a line-drawing exercise. You could make a free speech argument along the lines that Justice Kennedy made in the majority opinion that, well, let the Chinese government speak about who should be the U.S. president. If the Chinese government wants to flood the airwaves with their points of view, the voters in the United States could ignore what the Chinese government has to say. But I don't think that's where the court would be. I don't think that's where Congress would be or what American democracy wants for itself. We want to make sure that American democracy is structured in a way that is conducive to the citizens' needs. That requires respecting the First Amendment, absolutely, but it does require drawing some lines. So if you accept that proposition, then we're going to have to figure out what corporations are potentially dominated by foreign governments, foreign interests, and so they're on the wrong side of the line, so to speak. Another line drawing issue that's going to come up that didn't come up because, as Brad correctly said, the law at stake here was an absolute ban on all corporations, for-profits, non-for-profits, and it was the breadth of that law and the fact that it was an absolute ban as opposed to a ceiling on the dollar spent that caused the court to essentially say Congress, you know, wrote way too broadly in enacting this law. It used a sledgehammer instead of a scalpel, so to speak. The court referred to it as an asymmetrical response to the concern of potential corruption that might be at stake. So that leads you to ask, what if the congressional response is not asymmetrical and Congress does use as a scalpel, not a sledgehammer? So to give you an example, Congress should be most concerned about corporate spending when the corporation has particular ties to the government itself. That's true for two reasons. One, if you've got government contractors who are getting federal funds, there's the risk they could be using those federal funds and just turning it around to kind of distort the government itself. Other heavily regulated industries are often natural monopolies, and in essence, they form a government role. And so that when the government sets up a corporation to exercise that function, it's using the private sector to do its own business. The government would be concerned if that corporation was abusing its natural monopoly by spending money on politics. And a source of authority for that proposition happens to be Justice Scalia for an 8-1 decision in a case involving Amtrak from the 1990s. In that case, the Amtrak case, Justice Scalia and the court acknowledged there are special corporations which are not in the conventional private sector. They may be technically private corporations and not an agency of the government itself, but for First Amendment purposes, they actually function as part of the government, not within the private sector. And those corporations are not going to be allowed to spend money on federal elections for the same reasons that federal employees are not permitted to, or that the agencies of the federal government, like the Treasury Department, are not permitted to. And so we're going to have a line-drawing exercise about which of the kinds of corporations in America fall into that category that Justice Scalia recognized in the 1990s, or belong more appropriately in the private sector. Because Citizens United lumped them all together, the court said that was too much. Just quickly on two brief points, and then we can talk about this. There's two larger debates at stake in this case that we'll be talking about for a long time. One is on the doctrine or the methodology of original intent. You saw the dissent here engage Justice Scalia on exactly what was the original understanding of the framers with respect to corporations. And, you know, both sides made some points. It wasn't all one-sided, but it does show that Justice Scalia is not alone in able to claim the mantle of knowing what the original intent of the framers was. And then finally, on the issue of precedent and stare decisis, Justice Kennedy's majority opinion needed a lot of help from Chief Justice Roberts, who had to write separately on this point, because Justice Kennedy wasn't really straightforward with how he dealt with the precedents, and Roberts had to come to his aid. So Roberts does a better job there, but even Roberts, as I was reading his opinion, I kept wanting to ask, you know, Roberts was saying we've got to overrule Austin because we think it's wrong. Well, what's the difference? Roberts just got one more vote to join him, Justice Alito, replacing Justice O'Connor. It would have been awfully nice if somebody who used to think that Austin was right changed their mind, and that was the reason why the court was overruling. Instead, you've just got a replacement of judicial personnel, and that's not a good sign for the rule of law.
Brad, do you want to have a minute or two to respond or question?
Yeah. Thanks, Eric. I'm happy to respond to a number of things Ned said, and I actually agree with a number of his points, and I'm not sure that he disagrees with some of the things I said initially. It was a very broad law, and I think that's something that people simply have not been willing to recognize. And the court I think, did not want to put itself in a position where it was drawing some of these lines that Ned talks about in the first instance. So the court's response, and Kennedy spends quite a bit of time on this, is to say, you know, look, the statute is what the statute is, and we're not going to draw all these lines. Now, it may be possible that Congress can go back and try to draw more careful lines, and the court, you know, will look at them again. That's probably a better way to go than the idea that the court's going to start dicing up the statute, giving it improbable interpretations and so on to try to do that job. And to me, that's part of what makes this such a good decision, is that the court was taking, I think, very seriously, in a way that it has not always in recent years since Austin, its role in policing Congress here and saying, you know, you can't just do kind of this overkill, this asymmetrical response, this, you know, swatting flies with a sledgehammer sort of thing. There are a number of things that Ned mentions. For example, foreign corporations. Well, we already prohibit foreign nationals, which includes foreign-owned corporations, from contributing in American campaigns. You know, one might want to refine that law a little bit. It does not prevent, for example, foreign-owned subsidiaries if they're in the United States and so on. There's some, you know, issues there. And when we get to particulars, Ned and I might disagree on some of those, or we might not. But I think what's important there is that the ban there would not be because they're corporations. It would be, I think, because of the concern people have about the fact that they are foreign, that they are not part of the U.S. body politic, or people who are participating in our system. You know, similarly, Jamin Raskin, who's a scholar at American University that Ned and I think both know well, and a lively guy. Jamin is often challenged, as he likes to challenge conservatives, by saying, well, cities are incorporated. You know, do you want city government spending their budgets, you know, on elections? And I think he figures that you know, conservatives and libertarians like myself will go, oh, my gosh, no. But as I point out, they're limited not because they're corporations. They're limited because they're governments, something like what Ned was suggesting. And I think Ned's point about companies that are getting large government subsidies or bailouts is a very good one to consider. Do we really want General Motors, which is essentially now owned by the Obama administration, you know, campaigning with its government taxpayer handouts that it's gotten for the Obama administration? I think that's a very serious question. But the issue there would not be simply that General Motors is a corporation. Presumably we would apply that to General Motors even if it were some kind of partnership or some massively, you know, huge sole proprietorship. That's the issue, not really its corporate form. And I think that's what the court recognizes in this decision, is that Congress has to look at the evils that it actually claims to want to address and not just use this massive, you know, slashing thing here. I think there are two other points that I want to mention quickly. One is that overlooked here, there's kind of a sense that I've been seeing in media responses that, oh, you know, big corporations will dominate, you know, politics. And I've already suggested that the experience in the states does not show that to be true. But it's also worth noting that this is in many ways an egalitarian decision. That is, right now, large corporations that have lobbyists spend, you know, 10 times as much money lobbying as they spend on political spending of any type. And they will continue to do that. It's those large corporations that also can afford the expenses of maintaining and complying with all the legal requirements of having a PAC. And those large corporations that have enough managers and shareholders and executives that they can solicit contributions from for their PAC to build a big PAC that has some influence in the political regime. Smaller corporations, mid-sized companies, local companies that might employ 200 or 300 people in a town, they can't afford to maintain a PAC, and even if they could, they don't have enough people who are eligible to give to the PAC. Not every employee in the company can be asked for money. Only the executives and managers and shareholders can. And those companies don't have that ability to participate at all. So in a sense, this frees them up, and it's an egalitarian measure. That is, it equalizes relatively the strength of small corporations and large corporations. And I think in that respect will have some salutary effects. And then I'll throw out one other issue. I'll just toss it out now, and maybe we can get to it at some point. But one thing I think is very interesting about the two opinions, differing views. You know, Ned mentioned the original intent, but I want to talk about another issue, which is their differing views of the roles of corporations in American society and just what they actually are. The dissent kind of views corporations as something special. They're a creature of the state that is given all these various special privileges, and therefore the state can regulate them. Another colleague of ours in academia, Sami Zakharov, noted yesterday that they're kind of it's like Frankenstein's monster that's kind of absorbed the state. He was just describing it, not necessarily agreeing with that view. The other view is that, which is shown in the majority opinion and in the concurring opinion by Scalia in particular, is that corporations are simply the apotheosis of the modern way in which people join together to associate. You know, people have associated since time eternal. One of the things, distinctive things about America that Tocqueville noted, you know, 170 years ago was the tremendous extent to which Americans formed associations and groups to advance their interests. And this view is that corporations are not the kind of special enterprises that they were 200 years ago or even 100 years ago, given special monopoly powers by the government and things like that. They're just the way that people associate. And every little nickel and dime nonprofit corporation, every mom and pop, you know, jewelry store and barber shop, and they're all incorporated now. And that's the way that we conduct our affairs. And that should force some rethinking in the idea again of just having these blanket corporate bans.
Great. Ned, care to respond?
Yeah, just very briefly, thanks. Well, I think this conversation is constructive because, as Brad said, there's a lot of overheated rhetoric out there, and I think that's fair to say on sort of both sides of this issue. You know, people said that the sky was falling when Austin was decided. You know, other people are going to say the sky is falling now that Citizens United has been decided. I don't think the sky is falling either way, and you know, and that the truth is somewhere in the middle. And one of the points that Brad is acknowledging is that, you know, the character of the business enterprise and the role it plays in American society depends upon, you know, what its status is vis-a-vis Congress and the administration and how it should be treated. And we should handle that intelligently, you know, and with an eye to reality, not just through formalism and rigid doctrine. And I think his reference to General Motors is a good example of that. And so finding common ground, you know, on those examples, I think is good. And I agree with him in part on the point that the need to do that is not purely about the corporate form. And so, you know, to the extent to which Congress wrote a statute that was solely about the corporate form, had the kind of vulnerabilities that we were talking about. On the other hand, I think it's overstated to say that the corporate form doesn't matter at all. It should be, I think, a factor in the analysis. And the reason for that is, you know, these two views of the corporations that Brad is talking about, that have these images in the dissent in the majority are probably both a little overstated themselves. I mean, it's wrong to say that all corporations are Frankenstein monsters, and it's wrong to say, you know, that every corporation is just a mom-and-pop association of individuals. There is some truth to the notion, and it resonates in history, that corporations as a particular kind of association have a particular kind of privilege that they get from the government. And that privilege may come appropriately with some strings attached because they're in essence getting a government license in a way that other forms of associations of natural persons would not. Austin was premised on trying to make that argument kind of, you know, encompass the entirety of the corporate form, and maybe that went too far. You know, it probably deserved the respect of stare decisis, in my view, even if it was a little bit shaky on its own reasoning. But having said that, I think it would go too far in the opposite direction to say there's nothing to this notion of corporations being a privileged form of association. You know, this was a view that Justice Rehnquist believed. You know, it's a long-standing view. Justice Holmes believed it. And again, we don't have to adopt it wholesale with respect to every corporation. But, you know, so for example, with respect to the healthcare debate in America right now, one of the arguments that's made as an alternative to the so-called public option, and, you know, of course, the future of the healthcare debate is uncertain at the moment, but you know, over the last few weeks, people have talked about how in other countries, healthcare is perceived as a regulated industry. in a heavily regulated industry the way electric utilities or gas utilities are in the United States. If Congress, through democratic processes, wanted to choose that model for the healthcare industry and wanted to say that health insurance companies have a kind of public character to them, not that we're going to create a government monopoly to do healthcare through a single-payer plan, but we want to have a regulated structure that makes healthcare corporations be special licensees, that judgment should be a democratically acknowledged judgment and a way to target that industry for appropriate regulation, again, the scalpel, not the sledgehammer, that would mean that a law addressed to it would be very distinguishable from the across-the-board ban that was invalidated in Citizens United.
Thank you. I think I'm going to jump in a little bit with a couple questions. Just as an initial one, Ned, it strikes me that at least on the sort of the simple corporation question, so let's just say a reasonably local business, a car dealership or something like that, that's not involved with government contracts, that's not heavily regulated, that's not foreign-owned, none of these sort of special cases, but just what I think are the mine run of average everyday business corporations, I haven't heard you raise any real objection as to why this decision isn't at least reasonable or correct as to them. You sort of said it raises a lot of questions, and I suppose the argument, the discussion on special privileges might apply to sort of your simple everyday corporation. But what is your view of sort of, you know, the car dealership that happens to be incorporated?
Well, the first thing I'd say would be stare decisis, stare decisis, stare decisis.
I was asking on the merits more.
Well, but I appreciate that, and I'll get to that in a second. But I actually think that Citizens United, as important as it is as an election case involving campaign finance, is an incredibly important case about it, what it means in terms of constitutional law in the United States today and fidelity to the rule of law and the objectivity of law. And I think you ought to care about that if you care about the court as an institution, you care about constitutional law not being simply a personification of the will of the five individuals who happen to be in the majority. I think Justice Thomas has a view that the only thing that should matter is, you know, his view of the original understanding of the Constitution. He doesn't care about precedent. It's not even Justice Scalia's view, and it's not Roberts or Alito's view. But the court is struggling to have a coherent theory of precedent that, frankly, you know, stands up under scrutiny that they can abide by. And it's a sad day for American constitutional law when these opinions, and this is true of the dissent as well as the majority, because the dissent, I guarantee you, the dissent would overrule Citizens United as soon as they get a fifth vote on their side. And
of course they would. So wait, just putting aside the disingenuousness of most of the discussions of precedent pretty much over the last 100 years, let's focus on the First Amendment stuff for a minute. What
sure.
do you think of Austin as applied to the mine run of corporations that are not special cases like foreign or wholly government dominated?
Yeah, as I said or alluded to, I think Austin, you know, it's obviously on weaker ground. The more the balance favors the First Amendment side of the interest. There's balancing on both sides here. So to the small car dealership example that you give, I think the argument in favor of Austin, which I believe in on the merits, not just about precedent, is that, look, the corporate entity in and of itself, you know, is grounds for regulation. And as long as media corporations are exempt, I think that's not a matter of legislative grace. It has to be constitutionally required under the First Amendment. As long as nonprofits are exempt, either on the so-called MCFL decision or something like it, as long as the PAC option exists for individuals associated with a corporation, that is an appropriate balance for the legislature itself to regulate the competing interests of democracy.
Brad, let me turn to you for a minute, and before answering, you know, sort of some of the things that Ned has said, one of the things I'd like to ask you to address while you do that is, you know, what about this concern, at least as to sort of very large corporations, basically the inverse of what I just asked Ned, like McDonald's, like, you know, Ford Motor Company, assuming they hadn't taken lots of money, or GM before they had taken lots of money. There's some concern that, you know, folks that are that big are just going to drown out the rest of us. And admittedly, there are rich people who can speak pretty loudly too, or at least speak a lot, but they're not quite as big or quite as dominant as corporations, it seems to me.
Right. Well, I mean, empirically, I just don't think that's true. Again, I've mentioned that right now over half of Americans live in states that conduct their elections under exactly the rules that are now effectively in place nationally, that corporations and unions can make independent expenditures for candidates. And it's worth reminding people this case does not allow them to contribute directly to candidate campaigns. It doesn't allow them to spend the money in response to the candidate asking them to. You know, they have to do it independently of the candidate. And I do think that's a distinction that matters. But beyond the states, also in the federal government, you know, prior to McCain-Feingold, which limited corporate soft money contributions to political parties and corporate spending on issue ads, corporations did do those things. But again, I don't think many people would say that they drowned out our public debate in a way that's noticeably changed since McCain-Feingold. I think that's just not something that's a proposition many people would take too seriously. So empirically, I don't think the evidence is there. You know, I've seen some comparisons saying, well, total, you know, corporate profits in the U.S. were, you know, X amount, and why if they spent just 10% of that on politics, it would swamp everything. Well, they're not going to do that. That just doesn't happen. But if it did, I mean, one thing is the court might look again and say, well, okay, maybe there is a difference at some peak level, at some truly high level of giving where it ought to be watched and would be constitutional to do so. That's not an issue that the court's ever really been presented with. Instead, the court in Austin simply said, sure, you can completely ban it. And it is odd because what you suggest about big corporations goes back, oddly enough, to the original motivation of that corporate ban when it was first passed federally in 1907. A lot of people talk, and the Supreme Court has cited the words of Elihu Root, who was a big proponent of such a ban. And Root talked about the big insurance companies and the big railroad companies and the big telegraph companies, which were the huge corporations of his day. And as I say, at that time, corporations were much more a special form of organization. And when Root talked about them, he then went on and talked about these groups giving as much as $100,000 or spending as much as $100,000, which in today's terms would be over $2 million. Well, maybe if that's what we're talking about, again, I'm not sure that Ned and I would agree. I might still say, I think I'd probably still say, no, I think corporations should be able to spend that money and people should be allowed to hear. But we could at least look at that if it comes up. Nobody's ever really presented us with that as an actual real problem that the government in some way needs to address and really set that up for the court to look at squarely.
Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry. I don't mean
yeah.
that.
Oh, well, I was just going to say two things about a couple of the opinions, by the way. And one is, I know you don't really want to talk about it, but I will defend the court briefly on stare decisis. I mean, I think one of the things, first, there was a judge who changed his opinion on this, and it was Rehnquist, who in McConnell v. FEC, his last major campaign finance case, actually argued for overturning Austin, which he had voted for back in 1990. But also, I think that what you had here were two strands of campaign finance cases from the court, a strand highlighted by the 1976 case Buckley v. Valeo and the 1978 case First National Bank of Boston versus Bilotti, both of which said corporations and people can make independent expenditures. And then you had this 1990 case, which really kind of jumped out of nowhere almost and didn't claim to overrule Bilotti, but certainly went in a totally different direction, saying, well, you can ban corporate spending just because they're corporations. And those were two strands of authority that were really in tension with one another. So I think that's exactly the kind of case where the court might look to say, we've got to start thinking about how we harmonize these. And when you look at the sort of bludgeon approach of the statute that was upheld in Austin, of the statute that was before the court this week in Citizens United, it strikes me that it's pretty clear which strand of authority had to give. So I would defend the court's opinion a bit that way. But I would also note, and I'd just be curious if Ned thought this too, as we're getting near the end of our time here, I thought all of the opinions were actually kind of flaccid. I thought Kennedy's opinions, his dissenting opinion in Austin 20 years ago, in Wisconsin Right to Life, his concurrence just 3 years ago, his dissent in McConnell 6 years ago, where he, in all of those, he criticized Austin, I thought, much more effectively than he did in this week's opinion. And similarly, I thought Stevens' dissent, while it was extremely long, made very, very few points that really stood out and made you say, you know, I should rethink my position, or wow, that's a really powerful argument. It just seemed kind of like a long recitation of, you know, a lot of common cause press releases or something like that. I'm just kind of curious if Ned had the same reaction to the opinions or not.
Ned, just on the limited question, because I have one last question before our time runs out. So on the limited question, what did you think of the opinions?
Yeah, I share some of that. I was just in terms of opinion writing, was most impressed with Chief Justice Roberts trying to grapple with the issues of stare decisis. I mean, I think he came up a little bit short, but he took it on and he tried pretty valiantly, I thought, from his perspective. So, you know, whereas I do think both, you know, the Kennedy opinion did seem remarkably kind of stilted and weaker than one might have expected, especially given the time it took. And you know, Stevens kept apologizing how long his opinion was, and probably would have had packed a lot more punch if it had been punchier.
Well, one last question. Both of you have, we've talked a little bit about the notion that government privileges may have a bearing on the privilege holders' sort of exercise of their First Amendment rights. Brad mentions it in the GM context. Ned mentions it in the corporate context in general. As these are, in some sense, at least partial creatures of the government, given the greater or lesser degree of privilege they receive. And I wonder how you would take that notion and apply it to two circumstances. One, of course, is that many individuals, of course, receive extreme government privileges, not merely employment, but let's say Social Security beneficiaries or Medicare beneficiaries, where one might say that they, as a percentage of their livelihood, receive as much or more government support than GM does individually. I wonder whether or not that has some bearing. Perhaps it proves overbroadness, or perhaps it says we should worry about whether people on the dole get to argue for more dole. On the other side of the fence, we have the situation of governmental entities. I think Amtrak was mentioned already, and there are certainly a number of cases with government sort of sponsored commissions or corporations that in recent years have actually been held to constitute, their activities have been held to constitute government speech rather than sort of coerced contributions from their participating regulated entities. And by virtue of being government speech, they haven't been more heavily regulated, but in fact have been sort of freed up from First Amendment restraints, because, of course, the court in LMA says that the government gets to say whatever it wants. I wonder how this notion of privilege applies both to individual privileges and heavy government regulation of individual activities on the one hand, and the government's currently seemingly free hand to say whatever it wants using not only taxpayer dollars, but sort of coerced extractions from private trade groups. And I ask that to both of you. I'm curious. Either one of you can go first.
Well, sure. What the heck? Given the pause, I'll jump in. I think it's a legitimate concern. I think one thing that has been a concern, you know, in recent years in both Republican and Democratic administrations has been the growing concentrations of people on the government, you know, White House payroll, who are purely political people. Now, of course, it gets very difficult, and this is one of the foundations of the court's ruling yesterday, that it's very difficult to sort out when people are talking about purely politics, you know, partisan politics, and when they're talking about issues. And, you know, obviously the president is it's a political job, and he's going to have political people around him, and they're going to be planning an agenda and how to pass that agenda. But in recent years, there's been this tendency to put people in who really do seem to be nothing more than political folks. They don't seem to be at all concerned with sort of the operation of government. They're just concerned with the operation of the president's, you know, political obligations to his party, his planning for his next campaign. And I think that's troublesome. And I think it your broader point relating to, you know, corporations and so on, I think is also a troublesome point. You know, many individuals earn a great deal of money from working for companies that get various government contracts or whatever, and of course the individuals are free to spend the money. And I think that's part of the reason why when you get into this field, it's very, very dicey, and the best approach for the government is to really to keep its hands off. You start trying to say who's spoken too much, who needs to speak a little bit more. It gets harder and harder to keep drawing those lines. So this may, you know, represent a big difference in my approach from Ned's, and it's the same kind of approach that we sometimes see on the court between someone like Scalia, who wants bright lines, and someone like Breyer, who wants to look at all these cases in their complexity of their facts and so on. Is can you really keep drawing these lines, or do you get better justice by going ahead, putting the relatively crude bright lines there? For me, in the context of the First Amendment, that's saying the purpose of the First Amendment is to keep government out of this line drawing because we can't really trust it to do so without trying to, you know, put its thumb on the scale for favored interest and go with that. Or do you get better justice by trying to look, you know, more at those distinctions, which do at some point become increasingly fine and difficult to make? Ned?
I mean, there's a lot there that's very important and valuable. I mean, I think that the question goes to this big issue in American history and American law about the so-called public-private distinction. You know, we've grappled with it during the Lochner era and so forth. And in some sense, I guess we're grappling with it again, you know, both in our national debate over industries like GM that are in trouble, what's too big to fail, and so on and so forth, as well as, you know, Citizens United is timely in its arrival during this national debate. I think the important thing to do as we deal with these issues, again, is to kind of cool the temperature down and try to address these things with practical reason. I think there is a value to line drawing in the First Amendment context, as Brad said. On the other hand, undue rigidity is a danger, including in the First Amendment context. It becomes untenable. It leads to bad results. So, you know, sometimes Breyer's right, sometimes Scalia's right, sometimes you're going to have to muddle in the middle. Hopefully both sides in good faith trying to come up with some sensible answers. You know, acknowledge the legitimacy of the concerns, and also acknowledge, you know, there is a role for the court and there's a role for Congress. You know, just not all or nothing either way. We want the court to police Congress in the name of the First Amendment. We also need to give Congress latitude, you know, to democratically improve the machinery of democracy itself. You know, so the question about some of these entities that look like they're exercising governmental power, I think we're going to want to revisit the question of whether can they do whatever they want just because of the government? No, I don't think so. If the government steps in and says, we're going to give a lot of Treasury dollars to the Democratic Party so that it wins the next election against the Republicans, that's a First Amendment problem. We're going to have to figure out exactly how doctrinally to say so, but we know it to be so because the government cannot take sides in the political debate to that extent. And, you know, there will be other examples that are not that extreme, but that we'll want to say, you know, if the healthcare industry is paying for a Congress to prevent the regulation of itself, does that look like the government trying to decide who's going to win the next elections? They're not exactly the same case, but they may be close enough on the spectrum that you want to draw the line in one place rather than the other.
Well, I'll give each of you, you know, the last couple seconds. If there's something that we haven't touched on about these, you know, the recent opinion that you'd like to just sort of close with, feel free. If you feel we've covered it all, feel free not to.
I'm going to pass, and if Ned wants to add any more, I'll let him do that. Okay.
No, I'm done. I'm done. It's been fun, Brad. Take care.
All right. Let me
thanks,
close.
Eric. Thanks, Eric. Thanks, Ned.
Recorded. Yep. Well, thank you both, gentlemen, for this lively discussion, and that is the end of our podcast. Thank you again. Bye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.com. federalistsociety.org/multimedia.